I'm Jorge Salazar with the Texas Advanced Computing Center. In the midst of a global pandemic with COVID-19, it's hard to appreciate how lucky those outside of Africa have been to avoid the deadly Ebola virus disease. It incapacitates its victims soon after infection with massive vomiting or diarrhea, leading to death from fluid loss in about 50% of those afflicted. The Ebola virus transmits only through bodily fluids, though, marking a key difference from the COVID-19 virus and one that has helped contain Ebola spread. Ebola outbreaks continue to flare up in West Africa, although a vaccine developed in December of 2019 and improvements in care and containment have helped keep Ebola in check. Supercomputer simulations by a University of Delaware team that included an undergraduate supported by the Exceed Empower program are adding to the mix and helping to crack the defenses of Ebola's coiled genetic material. This new research could help lead to breakthroughs in treatment and improved vaccines for Ebola and other deadly viral diseases such as COVID-19. On the line to talk now about their research findings on Ebola are Juan Perilla, Chaui Shu, Tanya Nestorova, and Nidhi Kachyal. Perilla is an assistant professor. Shu is a PhD student. Nestorova, an undergraduate researcher. And Kachyal, a postdoctoral researcher, all in the Perilla Lab, Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry, University of Delaware. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thanks.
What are the main findings of your study on the Ebola virus? This was published in the 2020 Journal of Chemical Physics.
Our main findings are related to the stability of the nucleocapsid. So viruses, they have multiple components and, you know, they're like little machines, and part of those nanomachines or nanodevices are this thing called the nucleocapsid, which directly interacts with the virus genome. In this case, the virus genome is in the form of RNA, just like any other living creature in the world. What we've found is that the virus has evolved to regulate the stability of the nucleocapsid by forming electrostatic interactions with the RNA. So there is an interplay between the RNA and the nucleocapsid that keeps it together.
We found some molecule determined that control the stability of the Ebola nucleocapsid.
I don't really have much else to add other than what we used in order to find the stability. It was just molecular dynamic simulations and electrostatic analysis with sodium and chloride ions.
What is a nucleocapsid, and why did y'all focus in on this thing?
So nucleocapsids are protein shells that essentially protect the genetic material that the virus is used to replicate. Ebola nucleocapsid is more of a helically shaped structure, which is composed of, I think it was 3 protein subunits, right, Chaui?
Yes.
And they're repeated with helical symmetry, with the RNA kind of like a winding string on the inside. And this structure of having a helical nucleocapsid is very vital for transcription directly in the cytoplasm. There are other viruses, such as HIV, which have different structures that are asymmetrical capsids, or you can have icosahedral. But the helical nucleocapsid is specifically what we had to study. And the structure was obtained from a Nature paper. It was Sugita.
HIV also has a nucleocapsid, but it's not as organized as the one that we have in these viruses. So in general, the nucleocapsids are proteins that interact with RNA directly. So HIV also has a nucleocapsid that interacts directly with RNA.
The structure of the nucleocapsid, this was just, it's very recent, right? 2017, is that right? I mean, are these findings, you know, the basic knowledge of the structure, and then now you're finding out a little bit about how the relationship between the genetic material, the RNA, and the proteins around it, how they work together. Do these point to a weakness in this virus? Like, as you mentioned, something that can be used for a therapeutic down the road that can really help people, something like that is a lot easier to take and all that.
So we have figured out what are the key points where we can actually target. So for example, the RNA, we can target that. For example, the role of ions we have figured out. So that way, if they figure out what are the key determinants of that molecular stability so that we can target those key points and destabilize that.
So can you think of a specific point, like any like the regions that you guys identified?
For example, the NP-NP interactions.
So what are those? So maybe we can talk about how it comes together, like, you know, what is NP-NP?
Yeah, NP is a nuclear protein. So we have different nuclear proteins forming a helical arrangement. So the interface of those nuclear protein. So there are two kind of interfaces. We figure out that which of the interface basically plays a more important role. So we can actually target that particular interface to destabilize the helical symmetry.
It's almost like a Lego, if you want to think about it. But mm-hmm. You put together the little pieces, and as Tanya was saying, it's kind of like a spiral. And it forms, it's like a little spiral. And kind of like, you know, you have how many of these Legos you have per turn of this spiral? I don't remember, 14?
I think per turn is about 24, yeah.
Full turn, right? And then mm-hmm. it makes 24 units, and then you have another spiral and so on. And then you have this little spiral that goes up. And what he's talking about is the interactions between these Legos, you know, we call the nuclear proteins, right? It's almost like you put them together, it puts together itself. Nobody puts it together, right? It just assembles. And it's also a little bit more than just like it is self-assembled. It's like from what the simulations reveal, it also has this tendency to open up at the ends. And typically when you see these things in the simulations, they're usually related to some biological function. So it is known for other viruses, not so much for Ebola. We know a lot about, for instance, HIV, because there's been like 30 years of research just focused on the virus. So it's a good model organism. But we know that it's not just trying to, you might think naively that you can just attack the virus by trying to destroy this nuclear capsid, but they are tightly regulated. So actually, if you do the opposite, if you make it too stable, that's enough to make the virus dead, which seems counterintuitive, right? But at some point, it has to release its genetic material. So that's what happened is the virus needs to be able to come apart. But if you don't let it do that, if it is like overly stabilized, then that's also another strategy to develop these small molecules. And that's something that has been used in HIV, hasn't been used dramatically on other systems, but it's something that we can, because we know it works in HIV, something you can start to think about in Ebola once you start to look at how the interactions are there. So you rather than trying to destabilize, you can overstabilize. And similarly for other viruses, you can devise a similar strategy for coronaviruses, for hepatitis B viruses, any of these pathogens, you know, those capsids, these macromolecular assemblies are highly regulated and they're at a sweet spot, so to speak, right? And if you move it a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left, it has a detriment on the ability of the virus to infect cells. So I think that's also part of the story. It's like we know what confers stability. So other teams can go and look. It's like, okay, maybe this is a good druggable site for making it hypostable or making it hyperstable and so on.
Dr. Petty, you mentioned putting together the virus, you know, jokingly, but I guess in a way you do that with the simulations, right? Could you speak to how simulations allow scientists to be able to see things about the Ebola that they can't, right now, they can't see with the world's best microscopes? And what do these things that you're learning through simulations, what do these things tell scientists about some of the information that you're getting, like through this study? Some of the things that you mentioned in the study was the way that the genetic material is packed. Tanya mentioned the electrostatic potential, I believe, that plays a role in keeping it together. And also, I think Nidhi mentioned, the arrangement of nuclear proteins and also the residues in the helical assembly. These are things that come out of the simulations. Could you speak to what you're learning from these simulations?
Our simulation work is highly complementary of the experimental techniques. As you said, there's a lot of limitations to experimental experimentalists because of the size of these molecules, right? And they have to go through loops and holes to try to obtain a picture of what it looks might look like inside of the cell. And a lot of that is biochemistry. And that, by that I mean is that they might be able to get a structure, but it might not be in a biologically relevant state, right? And that happens quite a bit. For instance, the first nucleoprotein structure of Ebola, which I believe came out in 2017, didn't have RNA in it. And it was a big discussion. You know, I mean, this is all kind of like interesting because if you look back to the most famous double helix, the DNA double helix, right? There was a huge debate whether or not the bases were in or out. And they knew it was a double helix, but they didn't know if the base pairs were forming in or out. So there was a similar discussion with Ebola, is like, is the RNA inside of the tube or is it outside? And that was a huge discussion for many years. And many people believe, because there is another virus, the TMV, the tobacco mosaic virus, that also makes a helical arrangement. The RNA is inside. So everybody, because TMV, the RNA was inside, everybody believed that RNA was inside Ebola. So all the computational models put it inside, which were wrong, because when, and that's why I mean that it's not in a biologically relevant state, because when they actually were able to obtain complex, which is the one we use, the RNA nucleoprotein complex, the nucleocapsid, the RNA is outside. So, you know, like if you're a computational scientist, you might be tempted to just go and simulate the first one that came out back in 2017, just because, you know, it's an interesting target, but it's definitely not a biologically relevant state. It's, you know, it's a biochemically obtainable state, but it is not relevant to the biology of the virus versus the one that we simulated, which is biologically relevant. So that speaks to the limitations that experimentalists have to face. But on top of that, we can see things that they cannot see, which is we can see how things wiggle. Like if you think about like a football or soccer match, and if you just take pictures, you just know the beginning and the end. You don't know how the game happened, right? So you can't tell anything. It's like the most boring thing. Where that's kind of what they see is like they have these pictures maybe at the beginning of the game and then at the final, and they know the score. They don't know how the game went. But what we do is fill in the gap. We see the game, you know, like things are moving, like these amino acids are interacting with these others. There is some probability that they might interact in a different way in different regions. So that also gives us a lot of
statistics and obviously also a more detailed view of how things occur. And we can test hypotheses as well. I mean, we can introduce something we didn't do in this study, but we've done in other studies, which is start to look at what happens if we introduce a mutation here or there. You know, we can do computational biochemistry and it's just start to look at the effects of individual mutations on the stability or structural integrity properties of this capsid or nucleocapsid systems.
You can think of simulation work as a theoretical extension of experimental work. So I'm sure that you're familiar with in vivo and in vitro experimentation in biochemistry. A lot of the time people would call computational simulations in silico because of this. And there's still elements to our simulation that are not super biologically perfect that we can also help extend in future work, such as the addition of viral proteins, which were not included in our simulation. This paper was highly detailed and focusing on Ebola nucleocapsid with and without RNA. And without RNA, we consider that oligomerization of proteins into the helical assembly. And we found that RNA is highly negative and helps stabilize the nucleocapsid through electrostatic interactions with the mostly positive nucleoproteins.
Could you run us through the experiment a little bit, just in a nutshell? How was the experiment conducted?
Yeah, so as Juan and Tanya also mentioned, we built a structure based on the cryo-EM density map, which published in 2018, a Nature paper. And that structure, it has a density and also have a structure. So based on the density and then the structure of the monomer, we build a whole tube of the Ebola nuclear capsid.
So I want to clarify what we mean by a structure is the coordinates. And so like the coordinates and the,
the type of atoms that make the system. That's why by we mean by a structure. So I just wanted to clarify that because we keep talking structure, but somebody who doesn't know anything about structural biology might think that, well, okay, what is a structure? So maybe give a little bit of detail. Is the coordinates of the atoms. So for instance, you know, the structure of water is an oxygen and two hydrogens, right? So, and you know, they have different, certain coordinates. In this case, we have the coordinates of all high oxygens. We know where the oxygens are. We know where the nitrogens are. We know where the carbons are. And we know the, by that, we also know the relative distances. And that's what we mean by a structure. I just noticed we didn't define what we mean by a structure. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, that's good. Thanks for the introduction about the, actually it's not a pure structure, it's a combination of the coordinates. And then we put these coordinates into the electro experimental density, and we build the whole tube, of the Ebola tube. And then we build two systems. One is the Ebola nuclear capsid with the RNA, and the other one is just a nuclear capsid as a control. And then we run this simulation on the supercomputer. So after we build the whole tube, we add some, for example, we add also put the nuclear capsid in the environment that's similar in cell. So basically we put the ion, sodium chloride ion, and then we adjust their concentration to the concentration that in the cytoplasm. And also we also put a water box inside around the nuclear capsid, and that's a typical protocol to do that. And yeah, and then we run a very powerful simulation, yeah. So the simulation we run is we call it molecular dynamic simulation based on Newton's law. So basically it simulates the movement of the interaction of the atoms along the time, and we observe how they change during the course of the simulation. And based on this change, we can get some very useful information from this. For example, we can calculate the specific interaction between specific atoms. And then we can, for example, the nuclear NPNP interaction, which is a nuclear protein interaction from this simulation result. And also, I think Tanya also mentioned that we can also calculate the electrostatic potential of this whole complex. And also we calculate the ion occupancy from the simulation. Yeah, basically we can get a lot of information from the simulation, which cannot be obtainable from the experimental. So that's why Tuan said that our technique is a complementary to the experimental technique.
Y'all were awarded resources by the Extreme Science and Engineering Discovery Environment, funded by the National Science Foundation, XSEED. Could you speak to what XSEED resources you used? XSEED provides not only access to supercomputers, but also access to expertise to be able to get the most out of them. And there are also student programs. I think this is the first time I get a chance to talk about that. So maybe could you speak to how XSEED helped your work?
We are very thankful for the supercomputer resources that provide by the XSEED. Without that, this work was not impossible. XSEED also provides some training course, for example, some online training courses, and that will also have for maybe Tanya.
I was funded this summer by the XSEED Empower Scholarship, which is an apprenticeship program. The XSEED Empower program is an undergraduate program, and I believe that this is more so for advancement of minorities within computational sciences. And I think that it was a pretty effective program. You would have to use computational resources such as bridges we used for some resources this summer. Also very regular communication with the coordinator in order to keep your projects on track.
I use especially the Stampede 2 and Bridge. We used these two systems for maybe 2 or 3 years. The system is very useful for our research, as we mentioned. And we have completed several projects on these two machines. And specifically for Frontier, I think it just came out I cannot remember exactly, please correct me. I think it's last year or the year before last year. And we recently started using the Frontier, especially for the this Ebola project. And it's more powerful because it has the latest architecture of the CPU. Yeah. And it's very fast, much powerful than the Stampede 2 and the Bridges.
So, I mean, I guess something that is good is that it's part of the TAC infrastructure. So we kind of knew what tools were going to be there in terms of the development tools and also the queuing system and other intricacies of these machines. So that helped a lot. And in terms of architecture, we're familiar with the Stampede 2, although this is a slightly different machine. But I think that our experience with Stampede 2 allowed us to move quickly to start using Frontier. In terms of how much more you can do, I'll let Chaoyi answer. Erman, Needy, Chaoyi, and Tanya have been running more simulations these days than I do, so they can probably give you a better user perspective of the machine in terms of what you can do.
I like that in Bridges, when you run a simulation, you can be up to date on when it completes and when it started. So you can create stuff like Slurm scripts, which eventually you just get an email when the job is completed. And it also tells you a good amount about the wait time.
I think that the advantage of these supercomputer providers is that we can access to the extremely powerful supercomputer resources that we cannot get from local. For example, on Stampede 2, we have the access to run simulations on hundreds, even thousands of nodes. And this ability made us possible to run some simulation of a larger systems, for example, the Ebola nuclear capsid, this one. And this simulation is a kind of computationally impossible to run, to finish it locally. So that's very important. And by using these supercomputer clusters, we are able to run these kind of big systems and then to study their properties and finish lots of projects.
We've been talking about a lot of, I find this whole work fascinating, just on a day-to-day basis. It seems like it's the hardest science in the world with some of the most hard-to-understand machines in the world. Could you maybe break this down for like non-scientists who might be listening? You know, what's in it for them? How does research like this help? How does it relate to non-scientists who might be listening?
We don't have an immediate answer to a pandemic, for instance. But I mean, the more you know about your enemy, the more prepared you are to defend yourself and possibly develop new therapeutics, right? The success of these approaches in other viruses, particularly in HIV, which is a premature field, makes us think that what this knowledge that we're delivering will be used in the future to develop therapeutics, right? I think it's twofold. The gain that taxpayers gain is one is there is this new knowledge about an old virus, but there is also the new techniques, the new methods that are developed for these machines that can be used for the next virus, right? So Ebola has been causing problems for several years now, and in a way, it's our present. HIV is still our present. We look forward to the day when it will be our past. But we know that there are going to be more pathogens, and they just keep coming up anywhere if you look at, right? And particularly with coronaviruses, now we know that they're just around the corner and they can stop the world. So I think having not only the ability to study one virus, but taking these techniques to study a new virus, something like coronaviruses, which is in our portfolio, and having the ability to train new students, somebody young like Tanya, who's going to be having to deal with these things when I'm not doing this anymore. I think that the taxpayers get their money's worth in terms of, training the next generations and fighting the current problems and transferring a lot of knowledge from other viruses. Like, we are experts on HIV. That's been what we've been doing for many years. But now we can apply a lot of that knowledge to another virus like Ebola. And we can do it quickly because we're familiar with viruses, we're familiar with the simulation techniques, and we have the expertise to know where to look, right? So I think in that sense, the taxpayers sustain this ecosystem that is not just a one-time off publication.
it's an ecosystem. You know, you have the trainees that are going to go forward and look for new solutions to new problems. And we also look at our current problems in terms of what pathogens are affecting humanity right now. But yeah, we sadly don't tell the taxpayer, okay, we're not clinicians. We don't give them, you know, a drug, but we tell, okay, we give that knowledge to the general community, and that knowledge, it's what allows us or empowers the other scientists who do drug development to look at these things. They don't, and I think we're very lucky that have the opportunity to grow in an HIV field, and so that has been very successful in, you know, creating new therapeutics, and like the latest generation therapeutics are all based on structural analysis. I can't say that we're going to get a drug against Ebola in the next year with what we've done, but definitely it's yet another wealth of knowledge that can be used against the virus. So, and also, as I said, the people who are involved in this research are getting trained and learning how to use these tools developing these tools for future problems. I think that's also part of what the taxpayers get back from our contributions, and obviously, you know, and the generous funding that we get from National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health, and all these agencies that sponsor the research, which is definitely critical to our understanding of pathogens.
You've been listening to Juan Perea, Chao-Yi Xu, Tanya Nestorova, and Nidhi Katyal of the University of Delaware. For the Texas Advanced Computing Center, I'm Jorge Salazar.